And when the courage of our civic leaders wavers, when they fail to stand up for our country in its moment of greatest need, then we should remind them that cowardice always comes at a cost.
Excellent reminder, Governor Pritzker. Thank you.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
And there's no place I'd rather be stuck. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internet around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We've got a lot to get to today, a lot going on as usual, and a number of updates to several stories that we've been following in recent weeks. So glad you can be here. Let me start here on our show yesterday on Donald Trump's 100th day in office. And yes, that was on Wednesday, not on Tuesday, as so many in the corporate media, Desi Doyen, inexplicably recognized the largely meaningless landmark, but on the entirely wrong day, which kind of continues to baffle me even today.
Yeah, it was weird. But, you know, they're not all good at math. So, you know.
Do they have calendars? Can they count? 100 is not that high of a number. In any event, on our show, on Trump's actual 100th day of his second term in office, with Digby and Driftglass joining me, we discussed who we expected from Trump's cabinet to be thrown overboard first, given his absolutely dismal and plummeting poll ratings on just about everything at the 100-day mark. So, of course, he's got to blame someone for that. I suggested Pete Hegseth might be the first to go. Particularly after the pretty hilarious news this week that he was out crowing about axing a so-called woke Joe Biden initiative at the Pentagon regarding women and security. Turns out it was a policy, a law adopted by, yes, Donald Trump in his first term, and it was heralded by his daughter Ivanka as one of the crowning achievements of his first term. It was shepherded through Congress at the time by Trump's now DHS Secretary Kristi Noem, etc. That might have been the final straw after Hegseth's other headline failures, like sharing battle plans in an insecure signal chat with a journalist and with his wife and with his brother, etc. Digby thought it might be RFK Jr. For reasons that I'll let you discover on your own if you've yet to listen to yesterday's show. It's available for free thanks to listener support at bradblog.com. But today, Desi Doyen, it looks like we've got the answer to that question of who's going to be the first one thrown overboard.
Yes, we do.
Sort of. It's Mike Waltz. Who? Well, that is Trump's national security advisor. He's the guy who created the Signal chat group where Hegseth was sharing war plans with other high-ranking national security officials and the vice president and the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine for some reason. For a reason that we still don't know, but it was Waltz who inexplicably invited Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic into that group chat. And as The Times reports today, Trump is ousting his national security advisor, Michael Waltz, and another senior member of the White House foreign policy team, the first significant personnel overhaul of top aides in his second term. They report that Waltz had been on thin ice for months, but that the Signal chat seems to have been the straw that broke the national security advisor and former Florida congressman's back. Most of Trump's advisors had already viewed him reportedly as too hawkish to work for this president, who campaigned as a skeptic of American intervention. and that he was eager to that Trump is eager to normalize relations with Russia, to reach a nuclear deal with Iran, etc. Alex Wong, Waltz's deputy who worked on North Korea issues in Trump's first term and who's considered a moderate Republican with substantial national security experience, well, that's going to cost you in the Trump White House. He is also expected to be removed, according to senior administration officials. Trump is making the change just 2 weeks before his first major trip abroad to Saudi Arabia and other Arab capitals in the Middle East. Waltz barely had time to organize a staff, notes the Times, much less tackle the hardest issues facing the president. Ordinarily, a new national security advisor writes the administration's national security strategy, which is typically a year-long process. But he won't be doing that, apparently. Now, on Thursday morning, just as word of his ouster was beginning to circulate, Waltz was appearing at that time on Fox News. It is unclear whether he knew that he was being thrown overboard, thrown under the bus at that point. But hey, at least he made it longer than Trump's first national security advisor from his first term. That'd be Michael Flynn. He was fired just 24 days after Trump's first inauguration. Waltz at least made it just beyond 100 days.
And doesn't appear that he's going to be prosecuted for, I don't know, foreign entanglement.
We will see. Yeah, you'll recall Flynn was a retired lieutenant general. He's then turned into a crazy QAnon loon. Maybe he always was that. I don't know. But he was supposedly fired at the time in the first term, Michael Flynn, because the administration claimed he lied to then Vice President Mike Pence about talks that he held with the Russian ambassador after Trump's election, but before he took office. In fact, Flynn also lied to the FBI about those conversations with Russians and was eventually criminally charged. He pleaded guilty to those charges, only to see those charges eventually dismissed at the end of Trump's first term before he was granted a full pardon, I believe. So Waltz did better than that. And to help him save face, apparently, late on Thursday, the Trump administration announced that they were going to name Waltz to a different job, to become his UN ambassador, while naming Secretary of State turned complete Trump stooge Marco Rubio. He will be named as acting national security advisor at the same time that he is Secretary of State. In his first term, Trump ran through 4 national security advisors. So we'll see how long the next guy, whoever that ends up being, is able to remain in that role. So there's that. And in an encouraging update to a story that we've been covering now for weeks, months, actually, last week, you may recall, I was delighted to report that a federal judge ordered the restoration of the 83-year-old congressionally mandated and funded Voice of America, the international news outlet that was created originally by the U.S. to counter Nazi propaganda in Europe. It had been broadcasting continuously since 1942 until Trump ordered its parent agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, to be shut down back in March, I believe. Some 1,300 VOA staffers and contractors were sidelined as the airwaves fell of both VOA and its sister networks, Radio Free Asia and Middle East Broadcasting and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, fell silent after decades of what many regard as one of America's best projections of democracy and freedom of the press around the world, particularly with its broadcasts in more than 60 languages into authoritarian nations where real news is often entirely forbidden. And VOA and its sister networks have long served as a beacon to more than 400 million listeners around the globe each week. A number of VOA journalists and contractors filed suit, and as noted last week, the court ordered the U.S. Agency for Global Media to return employees and contractors from Voice of America, Radio Free Asia, and Middle East Broadcast Networks to their status as of pre-March 14, when they were all sent away. Even as Voice of America is not fully back, as the administration is appealing that ruling, but also the court in that ruling had not yet restored Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty. But this week, the same federal judge who took action last week ordered the Trump administration to restore $12 million that Congress appropriated for Radio Free Europe, the pro-democracy media outlet at risk of going dark now for the first time in 75 years. U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth, a very well-respected and 81-year-old conservative senior judge originally appointed by Ronald Reagan back in 1987, also, according to AP's coverage, tucked a lesson on the three branches of government inside his ruling this week, cautioning that the system of checks and balances established by the U.S. Constitution must remain intact if the nation is going to continue to thrive. Lamberth granted the order for the U.S. Agency for Global Media, USAGM, as it's known, to disperse money for April of 2025 for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty pending the outcome of a lawsuit seeking to keep the station on the air. He said the Trump administration could not unilaterally revoke funding that was approved by Congress for this. Quote, he said, in interviews, podcasts, and op-eds, people from both inside and outside government have variously accused the courts, myself included, he wrote, of fomenting a constitutional crisis, usurping the Article II powers of the presidency, undercutting the popular will, or dictating how executive agencies can and should be run, he wrote. But those notions reflect a, quote, fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the federal judiciary and of the Constitution itself, the judge said. Reasonable people can reach different conclusions in complicated legal disputes like this, he wrote, and that's why the appellate courts exist. The administration could also ask Congress to pull back the funds, he noted. Attorneys for the media outlet say that Trump's administration has terminated nearly all of its contracts with freelance journalists, as we were actually among the first to report on this show during our interview on this program with Voice of America's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, back in March, and missed payments on leases, they warned, would lead to more employees being furloughed, more contracts ending, if funding was not restored, forcing Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty to cancel more contracts and its core live news broadcasting and reporting operations entirely, according to their lawyers, who say that Radio Free Europe would otherwise have to cease operations almost entirely by June. So now they got another month, it seems. Unlike Voice of America, which began during World War II, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty started broadcasting during the Cold War. Its programs are aired in 27 languages in 23 countries across Eastern Europe, Central Asia, and the Middle East. The judge explained he has no dog in this particular hunt. He has no animosity to the president nor loyalty to the media outlets. But by issuing the ruling, quote, I am humbly fulfilling my small part in this very constitutional paradigm, a framework that has propelled the United States to heights of greatness, liberty, and prosperity unparalleled in the history of the world for nearly 250 years. If our nation is to thrive for another 250 years, he continued, each co-equal branch of government must be willing to courageously exert the authority entrusted to it by our founders.
Hear, hear.
A good lesson, I should say, in how our Constitution is supposed to work. So we will take that As some good news for today, the courts are still holding, mostly, for now, in D.C. And, by the way, even today, deep in the heart of South Texas, where on Thursday, a Donald Trump-appointed federal judge issued a first-of-its-kind ruling against Donald Trump and the administration, ruling that he unlawfully invoked the Wartime Alien Enemies Act to deport alleged Venezuelan gang members without due process, which the judge also blocked as of today. The federal judge on Thursday barred the Trump administration from deporting any Venezuelans from South Texas. In any event, under the 18th century wartime law, the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, and said invocation of it was, quote, unlawful. This is U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez Jr. He is the first judge to rule that the AEA, the Alien Enemies Act, cannot be used against people who, the Republican administration claims, are gang members invading the United States. As we initially told you on this show way back in March, stepping through the actual text of the law in question from 1798, which allows U.S. officials to detain or deport migrants without due process, but only in the case of migrants coming from a nation that has declared war on the U.S., or in the case of an invasion directed by their country. And as far as anyone could tell, Venezuela has neither declared war on the U.S., nor has it directed an invasion of it, as the Trump administration seems to be claiming. Quote, neither the court nor the parties question the executive branch can direct the detention and removal of aliens who engage in criminal activity in the U.S., wrote Judge Rodriguez. But, he said, the president's invocation of the AEA exceeds the scope of the statute and is contrary to the plain, ordinary meaning of the statute's terms. Well, who knew? Oh, yeah, we did. In March, Trump had issued a proclamation claiming that the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua was invading the U.S. He claimed he had special powers to deport immigrants identified by his administration as gang members without the usual court proceedings, which are known as constitutional due process, a bedrock principle of our constitutional Republican democracy. The judge wrote, quote, the court concludes that the president's invocation of the AEA through the proclamation exceeds the scope of the statute and, as a result, is unlawful. There was no immediate comment from the White House, but the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Rep. Adriano Espaillat, said of New York, said in a statement that the judge had made clear, quote, what we all knew to be true. The Trump administration illegally used the Alien Enemies Act to deport people without due process. The act has only been used three times before in U.S. history, always during wartime. Most recently, during World War II, it was cited to intern Japanese Americans at the time, shamefully. And, by the way, it was used to detain or deport Nazis from the country, even though the Nazis were actually given due process of some 30 days to challenge their detention or deportation under the law, unlike the more than 200 alleged Venezuelan gang members, many of whom are apparently not even gang members, before they were sent off to a maximum security gulag in El Salvador back in March without access to attorneys, perhaps for life. Judge Rodriguez's ruling is significant because it's the first formal permanent injunction against the administration using the AEA and contends the president is misusing the law. It's also significant, of course, because it was issued by a judge that Donald Trump himself appointed to the federal bench back in 2018. So I guess he's not going to be able to call him a wild-eyed liberal and call for his impeachment, but I'm sure he'll come up with something.
Probably.
The ACLU attorney leading the response, Lee Gelernt, said in a comment in response to the ruling, quote, "The court ruled the president can't unilaterally declare an invasion of the United States and invoke a wartime authority during peacetime. Congress never meant for this 18th century wartime law to be used this way," he said. "This is a critically important decision that prevents more people from being sent to the notorious Cecot prison. At least for now, at least in South Texas." Judge Rodriguez agreed with the ACLU here. Trump claimed that Trendaragua was acting at the behest of the Venezuelan government, but Judge Rodriguez found that the activities the administration accused it of did not amount to an invasion or a predatory incursion, as the statute requires. As the judge wrote, Trump's, quote, "proclamation makes no reference to and in no manner suggests that a threat exists of an organized armed group of individuals entering the U.S. at the direction of Venezuela to conquer the country or assume control over a portion of the nation. Thus, the proclamation's language cannot be read as describing conduct that falls within the meaning of, quote, invasion for purposes of the AEA." Of course, if the administration appeals, which I suspect is almost certain they will, it would go to the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, which is the nation's most right-wing appeals court. The Supreme Court itself has already weighed in once on the issue of deportations under the AEA. The justices held that migrants alleged to be gang members must be given, quote, "reasonable time to contest their removal from the country." The court has not specified, however, the length of time that is considered to be reasonable, though a judge in Colorado, I believe, recently said that those held under the AEA must be given at least 21 days to challenge any deportation, while the administration has been trying to get away with giving them just 12 hours while in custody to find a lawyer and file legal challenges to their cases before trying to spirit them out of the country forever into a gulag in El Salvador. No matter what the Fifth Circuit does, however, the case is likely to head back to the high court again, though the Trump-packed court has already been forced to deal with one of these cases a second time on an emergency basis. Late last month, the justices stepped in the middle of the night, on a Saturday night after midnight, very unusual, but they ordered the halting of a bunch of new deportations to El Salvador from North Texas. They did so by a 7-2 ruling. Justices Alito and Thomas, naturally, were the lone dissenters. They would have shipped these people off to the gulag without any due process whatsoever. The court in that case said that there were to be no more deportations under the AEA until the Supreme Court rang in again on the matter. And for now, a Trump judge in South Texas has forestalled that possibility. Again, for now. All right, quickly before we get to a break, some encouraging news, not just coming from the courts today, as Nancy Levine Stearns, who's been following these sort of attempts by right-wingers to force major American companies to end anti-discrimination or DEI programs, she reports on Blue Sky that in a vote on Wednesday, Coca-Cola shareholders voted to reject two anti-DEI proposals at their annual meeting, both of them 99-1%. She notes that proponents of the proposals described Coke's anti-discrimination policies, described as a DEI, as, quote, anti-American, neo-racist, and neo-Marxist. Apparently, anti-discrimination is now Marxist. As the company and the shareholders opposed the proposal, they argued that such programs play an important part in Coke's success. They said Coke is that diversity, equity, and inclusion play an important part in our company's success. But if Coke is now un-American, I don't know what to tell you. I wonder what they say about Levi Strauss at this point. But we don't have to wonder, because Stern also reported about a week ago that Levi Strauss shareholders also voted to reject a similar proposal, calling on the company to cease and abolish all DEI efforts. Levi's board of directors responded, saying, quote, "Diversity and inclusion principles are critical in ensuring that our products reflect and are relevant to our diverse global customer base." Good for them. All right. Even the most American of American companies, apparently, still have the courage, it seems, to push back against this nonsense. Though I do understand that Pepsi recently did the opposite, which, if true, is just another good reason, as if anyone needed one, to choose Coke over Pepsi. So have a Coke and a smile today, I guess. So let's take a quick break here. We will come back with some Democrats, a couple of Democrats who already seem to be running for 2028 and are already pushing back themselves against both Donald Trump and some of their fellow Democrats. One of them is doing so against Democrats who may not be pushing back as hard as they should. That and Desi Doyen's Green News Report are all still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Hey, former Vice President Kamala Harris, you've heard of her, right? She used a high-profile speech on Wednesday night to sharply criticize Donald Trump. Well, about time. That amid speculation about whether she's going to mount another presidential campaign in 28 or she's going to run for governor out here in California. In her most extensive public remarks since leaving office in January after her defeat to Trump, Harris said on Wednesday that she is inspired by Americans fighting Trump's agenda despite threats to their freedom or livelihood. And that's an important point. I have noted in the past that I do not look to Democrats for leadership. In many cases, I don't care what they do. I look to the people to lead those Democrats, those elected officials. And that's what the people have been doing, clearly. And Democrats like Harris have indeed noticed. And of course, they are now following the people. Before Wednesday, she had barely mentioned Trump by name since she conceded defeat to him in November. Harris chose a friendly audience for her return to the political arena, addressing the 20th anniversary gala for Emerge America, which is a group that recruits and trains Democratic women to run for office. Apparently, it came out of her own run for San Francisco district attorney back in the early 2000s. She praised Democrats in her remarks who have been especially prolific in criticizing Donald Trump, name-dropping lawmakers diverse in their ideology and style, like Senators Cory Booker, Chris Van Hollen, Chris Murphy, Bernie Sanders, along with members of Congress, Jasmine Crockett, Maxwell Frost, AOC. But she did not take a stand. In one of her party's central divides, as AP sees it, neither calling for mass mobilization like Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has, we'll get to him in a moment, or questioning Democratic positions on key issues like California Governor Gavin Newsom has been doing of late, as we discussed on our show yesterday with Digby and Driftglass a bit. In Harris's remarks, she spoke to the anxiety and confusion that have gripped many of her supporters since Trump took office, but she discouraged despair.
Instead of an administration working to advance America's highest ideals, we are witnessing the wholesale abandonment of those ideals. And what we are also seeing in these last 14 weeks is Americans using their voice and showing their courage. President Trump and his administration and their allies are counting on the notion that fear can be contagious. What they have overlooked is that fear is not the only thing that's contagious. Courage is contagious. The courage of Americans who are banding together in the face of the greatest man-made economic crisis in modern presidential history. The courage of Americans we are seeing who are rallying at Social Security offices to protect their hard-earned benefits. Of Americans who are speaking out to say, it is not okay to violate court orders. It is not okay to detain and disappear American citizens or anyone without due process. And we here know that when the checks and balances ultimately collapse, if Congress fails to do its part, or if the courts fail to do their part, or if both do their part, but the president defies them anyway, well, friends, that is called a constitutional crisis. And that is a crisis that will eventually impact everyone. Because it would mean that the rules that protect our fundamental rights and freedoms, that ensure each of us has a say about how our government works, will no longer matter. And if that happens, the one check, the one balance, the one power that must not fail is the voice of the people.
Former Vice President Kamala Harris in San Francisco on Wednesday night. So in a couple of recent roundtable shows with our OG blogger friends, Heather Digby Parton and Drift Glass, Drifty, who's an Illinois native, has cited his own state's governor, billionaire Democrat J.B. Pritzker, as someone that national Democrats should keep an eye on in advance of 2028. And yeah, I know it's early, but I've been actually finding it somewhat comforting of late to keep an eye on the far horizon and how we are going to get there. And Drifty actually knows a thing or two about this. Years ago, he was actually part of a group of Democrats who vetted some guy named Barack Obama for higher office back when he was running for Congress in Chicago back in 2000. Now, Obama lost that race at the time, but he went on to win election to the U.S. Senate 4 years later. Now, I don't know whatever happened to that guy after that, but J.B. Pritzker was in New Hampshire on Sunday, the Illinois governor, which is where you go to New Hampshire along with Iowa. And, you know, you'll find many potential presidential candidates beginning to meet supporters in advance of potential presidential runs out there. Pritzker spoke at a Democratic fundraiser on Sunday where he, I believe, was the keynote speaker.
Yes.
I quoted some of his remarks on the show yesterday to get Drift Glass' response, and both he and Digby seemed to be very impressed with Pritzker. So I haven't been able to get to this in what's been another busy week for a change until today. But before it slips away, I think it's worth sharing some of his remarks in Manchester with you today, as they may be encouraging even before we get anywhere near the 2028 presidential primaries, as Pritzker sort of lit up, you know, one hell of a stem winder, set the place on fire, and it seems to have inspired a lot of Democrats and, frankly, ticked off a lot of Republican Trumpers. So here is some extended excerpts from Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's remarks on Sunday in Manchester, New Hampshire.
In this fragile moment, the direction of this nation will turn on who we choose to listen to, whose stories we decide to tell about what is happening, who we elevate and who we ignore, who we find noteworthy and who we label as just noise. Who we listen to will shape the way we react to events as they unfold. Fellow Democrats, for far too long, we've been guilty of listening to a bunch of do-nothing political types who would tell you that America's house is not on fire, even as the flames were licking their faces. Today, as the blaze reaches the rafters, the pundits and politicians, well, the pundits and politicians whose simpering timidity served as kindle for the arsonists, they urge us now not to reach for a hose. Meanwhile, if we took care to listen to the voices of real people, we would hear our neighbors and our friends standing on the streets, outside, screaming for a response, one big enough for a five-alarmer. So today I want to talk to you about those people. I want their voices to be what we hear, their stories to be the ones that we tell. Andy Smith. Andy Smith lives in Edwardsville, which is a small city in southern Illinois. On February 4th of this year, Andy took a homemade sign to a spot where she figured she would get the most visibility, the intersections of highways 157 and 143, and on her own, she lifted up her sign and she started protesting the Trump administration. Later, she told the local paper that on that first day, she felt like a crazy person standing out there all by herself. And then someone walking her dog saw her sign, stopped, and decided to join her. That helped, Andy said. The next day, February 5th, Andy showed up to protest again, and this time four friends came to join her. Well, 2 days later, on February 7th, the small but hearty band of Edwardsville protesters got their first counter-protester, one guy who yelled obscenities at them. But in true Midwestern fashion, that guy later returned to apologize. Andy Smith's protesters now meet every Friday at 1 p.m. Last week, there were 300 of them. Gavin Carpenter is a disabled military veteran and a maintenance mechanic at Yosemite National Park. Every February, Yosemite fills with people waiting to see an event that happens only once a year. The winter sun lights up a waterfall on the face of the park's most famous cliff, El Capitan. This year, on that day, Gavin climbed to the top of the cliff and he hung an American flag upside down, famously known as a signal of dire distress. When asked why he did it, Gavin pointed to the cuts that Elon Musk and Doge were making to his beloved national parks. And he said, "We're bringing attention to what's happening to our parks, which are every American's properties." Lucy Welch. Lucy writes the Daily Snow Report at the Sugarbush Resort in Vermont. Last month, J.D. Vance went on vacation at Sugarbush. So Lucy decided to write, well, a very different kind of snow report. Instead of the usual details about powder conditions and weather, she wrote about what was happening to the diverse and wonderful community of veterans and people with disabilities and LGBTQ plus friends and immigrant workers and people of color. She wrote, "All of these groups are being targeted, undervalued, and disrespected by the current administration." And she finished her snow report by writing, I am using my relative platform as snow reporter to be disruptive. I don't have a whole lot to lose. We're living in a really scary time, in a really serious time. What we do and don't do matters. Andy, Gavin, Lucy, those are the names that we should be paying attention to. Those are the stories that I want to share. No pontification, no punditry there, no tortured op-eds about party messaging, no hand-wringing over which battles to pick. These three Americans acted on an instinct that we teach our children as one of their first lessons in life. When you see a danger, you yell for help at the top of your lungs. We Democrats, we shouldn't be comfortable ignoring those cries for help. The fact that so many are speaks to the real reason that we lost last November. What I find ironic about the current conversation surrounding our party is that the voices flocking to podcasts and cable news shows to admonish fellow Democrats for not caring enough about the struggles of working families are the same ones who, when it comes to relief of the struggles of real people, have been timid, not bold. They didn't want to fight the health insurance companies and the drug manufacturers. They didn't want to demand an increase in the minimum wage or require paid family leave. They gave in to the powerful hedge fund managers and tech bros whose blind pursuit of profits is now destroying everything that matters to middle-class families, from home ownership to health care to veterans' benefits. They told us to ignore the fact that most Americans can't afford a vacation while they're young or retirement once they're old. Here's the problem with the do-nothing crowd, now telling us what to do. Well, they spent their years watching Republicans illegitimately pack the Supreme Court, take away voting rights from people of color, systematically chip away at the constitutional order. And all the while, they offered, in response, a simple defense of norms and decorum and a blind hope that one day soon, Republicans would wake up to find their better angels. Well, that got us exactly where we are today. So, folks, the reckoning is here. And now that this culture of timidity is on full display, those same do-nothing Democrats want to blame our losses on our defense of black people, of trans kids, of immigrants, instead of their own lack of guts and gumption. Voters didn't turn out for Democrats last November, not because they don't want us to fight for their values, but because they think we don't want to fight for our values. We need to knock off the rust of poll-tested language. We have to abandon the culture of incrementalism that has led us to swallow the cruelty and the callousness with barely a cowardly croak. It's time to fight everywhere and all at once. Now let's start with something that should, well, be easy to say. It's wrong to snatch a person off the street and ship them to a foreign gulag with no chance to defend themselves in a court of law. And I want to be clear, this is not an argument about immigration. This is an argument about the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton wrote that the practice of arbitrary imprisonments has been, in all the ages, the favorite and most formidable instruments of tyranny. Standing for the idea that the government doesn't have the right to kidnap you without due process is arguably the most effective campaign slogan in history. It's the OG of political messaging. Today, it's an immigrant with a tattoo. Tomorrow, it's a citizen whose Facebook post annoys Donald Trump. Immigration, with all its struggles and its complexities, is part of the secret sauce that makes America great always. The success of our economy depends upon immigrants. The return on investment for America's 250-year commitment to immigration is incalculable. If the best and the brightest around the world no longer flock to this shining city on a hill, then the U.S. economy is likely to fail. But failure, it's starting to look like that's the point of all this, doesn't it? Democrats, we may have to fix our messaging and our strategy, but our values are exactly where they ought to be. And we will never join so many Republicans in the special place in hell reserved for quislings and cowards. It's time for us to be done with optimism about their motives or their objectives. Time to stop wondering if you can trust the nuclear codes to people who don't know how to organize a group chat. And if it sounds like I'm becoming contemptuous of Donald Trump and the people that he has elevated, it's because I am. They're an affront to every value this country was founded upon. But there's a way out of this mess. Listen, I understand the tendency to give in to despair right now, but despair is an indulgence that we cannot afford in the times upon which history turns. Never before in my life have I called for mass protests, for mobilization, for disruption. But I am now. These Republicans cannot know a moment of peace. They have to understand that we will fight their cruelty with every megaphone and microphone that we have. We must castigate them on the soapbox and then punish them at the ballot box. They must feel in their bones that when we survive this shameful episode of American history with our democracy intact, because we have no alternative but to do just that, that we will relegate their portraits to the museum halls reserved for tyrants and traitors. And when the courage of our civic leaders wavers, when they fail to stand up for our country in its moment of greatest need, then we should remind them that cowardice always comes at a cost. In the world's most successful republic, no generation of Americans has escaped our true inheritance, the test that we are given that asks how hard we are willing to fight to keep our society free. It was selfish to think that ours would be the first. But the fact that we are still here, debating the question, tells me our predecessors never failed this test in the past, often in situations just as dire as the one in front of us. Cowardice can be contagious, but so too can courage. And courage born during times when complacency beckons like a siren call is the most important kind of all. Just as the hope that we hold on to in the darkness shines with its own special light. These days, I cling to the courage and the hope demonstrated by Andy and Gavin and Lucy. Courage and hope that risks limbs and livelihoods to go to the most visible place possible, to wave a sign or to post an upside-down flag and remind everyone that what we do and what we don't do matters. So tonight, I'm telling you what I'm willing to do, and that's fight. For our democracy, for our liberty, for the opportunity for all of our people to live lives that are meaningful and free. And I see around me tonight a room full of people who are ready to do the same. So I have one question for all of you, Granite Staters. Are you ready for the fight? Yeah. For real, Granite Staters, are you ready for the fight? Good night, New Hampshire. God bless you, and God bless these United States.
Go big or go.
Oh, he's running some tightly edited remarks there from Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker in Manchester, New Hampshire on Sunday. All right, quick break, and we're back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. That is straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey,
Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
By the way, Desiree, yep. Nice job cutting that Pritzker speech. I know you wanted to carry the whole thing because there was a lot of stuff there.
Yes, both he and Kamala Harris did excellent speeches. I highly recommend going and watching and listening to the whole thing.
There you go. We will link to it, of course, when we post the show at BrandBlog.com tonight. But before then, our latest Green News Report.
We are once again at one of those hinge moments of history.
Liberal Party Prime Minister Mark Carney, climate action expert, wins critical election in Canada. Trump White House announces deal to access Ukraine's rare earth minerals. Plus, half of Americans are breathing in dangerous levels of air pollution.
Which half? Never mind. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
So the deal was signed. What are the details of it?
Well, I don't have the details that I can share with you at this particular moment in time, but it's because it's President Donald Trump. It is the perfect deal.
That was the State Department spokesman. Has no idea what's in the deal, but knows that it's perfect. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, what's in that perfect Ukraine deal? Do you have any idea?
Only the barest of details.
But it's perfect.
That's what they say. The Trump White House announced Wednesday it had signed an economic deal with Ukraine, giving the U.S. access to Ukraine's vast, valuable, critical mineral wealth and its natural resources, plus a share of the proceeds, after Donald Trump pressured Kyiv to compensate the U.S. for helping Ukraine repel Russia's brutal invasion. The two sides offered only bare details about the deal's structure, but Kyiv will maintain ownership of its minerals, and the state-owned companies used to mine the critical minerals used in a host of applications, including electronics and electric vehicles. It reportedly provides Ukraine with a measure of assurance about continued American support in its grinding war with Russia.
Well, for what I think it's worth, knowing nothing about the deal, actually, I think it's a good deal in that it keeps Donald Trump with skin in the game to keep helping Ukraine. Is it perfect? I don't know.
This week, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and his Liberal Party won a decisive election victory, propelled by Trump's insults and threats to acquire Canada as the 51st state.
Now that is perfect.
Carney is a climate action stalwart who spent 5 years as the United Nations Special Envoy on Climate Finance and co-founded a global initiative to mobilize private capital to decarbonize the economy. Carney vowed to forge a united path forward for Canadians independent of the United States in his victory speech.
It's time to build Canada into an energy superpower in both clean and conventional energy. And it's time to build an industrial strategy that makes Canada more competitive while fighting climate change.
Well, that's even more perfect than I thought.
Here in the U.S., the New York Times reports that the Trump Environmental Protection Agency will cancel tens of millions of dollars in research grants addressing environmental hazards faced by children, particularly in rural America, like pesticide exposure from agriculture and other pollutants like wildfire smoke. Mm. In other news, half of Americans are breathing in dangerous levels of air pollutants, according to the American Lung Association's annual State of the Air report. Although air quality across the country has improved dramatically since the Clean Air Act and other regulations were enacted, unhealthy levels of soot and smog in 2024 rose 16% higher than 2023, the highest number in a decade.
That's not good.
Soot and smog, which are worsened by heat waves and wildfires, wildfires increase the risk of serious illnesses like asthma, heart attacks, strokes, cancers, preterm births, and dementia. The researchers warn that air pollution is likely to increase even more in coming years due to the climate crisis and the Trump administration's sweeping environmental rollbacks. Despite considerable progress, Los Angeles remains the nation's smoggiest city, but the Trump Environmental Protection Agency is working to revoke California's special decades-long waiver to set its own tailpipe pollution standards that have dramatically reduced the region's notorious air pollution. But California is moving ahead, investing state funds to put 1,000 electric school buses on the road to reduce school children's exposure to air pollution in more than 130 rural and low-income districts. California's funding comes from revenue from a state carbon tax program that caps emissions and requires polluters to pay for the carbon they release. More than 500 school districts nationwide, however, are still waiting on the EPA to provide more than $1 billion in grant money for them to purchase thousands of clean electric buses.
I'm afraid they'll be waiting for a while. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible thanks to those of you who hit a donate button at bradblog.com, or please consider going to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay and continue the fight over your public airwaves. We need your help now more than ever. You've heard me say it before. I'm not kidding. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you will find me on the social medias, especially at Blue Sky at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.